Morning again, Mr. Spray, and you may proceed now. Mr. Paul, do you need to see these exhibits?
Yes, sure, I took a look at this one, I haven't seen this other one yet.
And there's one behind.
There's one behind here, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, is that sufficient?
For now, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Spray, you may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name's J.L. Spray, along with my partner Patty Van Oy, who I think is obscured now from vision, and our colleague Jake Garbison, who will be assisting me. We represent First Nebraska Trust Company and 146 other account holders, including family trusts, individuals, family units, and others who took assignment of the claim of AIG's insurer Don Barry and Mike Stanfield of VSR Financial Services. There are 14 assignments of error, not including subparts. All of them lead to the penultimate error of not clearly and unequivocally finding there was coverage for the claim and that the exclusion cited by AIG, endorsement number 6, does not apply. So I'd like to start with the most straightforward roadmap for resolving the case with guidance to the parties and, of course, to the trial court. The court should find in their review that this claim was covered under the broad insuring language of the contract. And then this court should examine the exclusion, giving it the narrow analysis demanded by the Kansas courts, and find the exclusion is either inapplicable or indiscernible. So in examining the fifth assignment of error, this court should affirm the trial court's determination of coverage overall, but hold that the professional services for others for a fee exclusion is not applicable. There are a number of reasons the district court got that wrong. One, some of the 12 respondents in the arbitration were not professionals at all. Two, the work done by VSR is not a profession. Three, supervision and management of a business is a separate and distinct act from what the actions of the person you're supervising. In other words, if I'm supervising a drunk driver, that's a different mistake from the drunk driver hurting somebody. Four, then there are issues about who the others are because it's professional services for others for a fee. And five, what is the fee? There were no fees resulting from the activities of this broker on these particular facts. On this record, this court can also find that AIG's actions and inactions were negligent and performed in the absence of good faith. Now, there are some very key facts. First, AIG determined that this claim was not covered. This is the top of the only correspondence and only communication AIG sent to their insurer. You'll note that it's from AIG Domestic Claims, Inc. The first sentence says, AIG Domestic Claims, Inc. is working with National Union. That is who we're directed to correspond. And of course, the most important part of this exhibit is the purpose of this letter is to advise you that the policy does not afford coverage for this matter. Any part of it, no coverage. And if you have no coverage, you don't have a defense, you don't have an indemnity, you don't have any rights at all. And of course, once they abandon their insured, all the rest of the facts involved here flown from that. So that act or inaction by AIG is the true origin of all the damages of defendants.
In that exhibit, did they also say because there was no coverage, there was no duty to defend?
No, not directly, but if you read the insuring language, about the second paragraph says, you can get a defense, you can tender a defense, you can look at endorsement number 8, but it only applies if you have coverage. So once you lose coverage, you're done. Nothing else matters. All the rest of it is just pixie dust about tendering and defenses and la-di-da. They deny coverage. That's the key point.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The purpose of this letter, was it in response to a request for a coverage opinion?
It was in response to a claim. You know, under Kansas law, the insurer has a duty to treat their insured at least as well as they can look out for themselves. And to deny that this was a claim would be to put the insured's interest far above the insurer's interest. Because all they had to do is pick up the phone and say, do you mean this to be a claim? You file it through our claims portal. It says claim. We're referring to it as a claim, right? We're saying no coverage for this matter. That's how they took it, right? So, in answering your question, I think clearly it was a claim. Second, they did this analysis by analyzing the wrong policy. So this board shows the actual endorsement language that they used to exclude the coverage. It says professional services or others for a fee. Mr. Usinger, the claims analyst, who analyzed this claim because his supervisor told him how to come to the conclusion she thought he should come to, and he did precious little beyond that. When he analyzed the claim, he analyzed the wrong policy. Perform professional services for a fee, no for others. Now, assuming words have meaning, they improperly analyzed the policy because they were looking at the wrong policy. And third, after the claim was filed and flat out denied, the insurer made another effort to communicate with them. This is the envelope of the letter that was sent. In that letter was a settlement offer, was other additional facts, and was Kansas case law. This letter was received by AIG. This stamp is Mr. Rory Burton, who we deposed in downtown Manhattan. He admitted that he received this letter. It's addressed to Mr. Crusoe and Usinger, but most importantly, it's addressed to AIG Domestic Claims, Inc. AIG Domestic Claims, Inc. AIG Domestic Claims, Inc. And you know what happened to this letter? They lost it. It never got where it needed to go. It was never responded to, never acknowledged. The only correspondence from the insurer in this whole thing was this one letter on September 11th.
I want to go back to the duty to defend. Prior to receiving the exhibit on the left, had you tendered formally the defense to AIG?
No, but what difference would it have made? The claim was denied.
I'm saying before you got the denial of the claim, had you formally tendered the defense?
No, this was an insured who, first time they ever made a claim on the policy, they didn't know what they were doing. They were your typical insured, just like if you made a claim on your homeowner's policy. Would you necessarily read it and determine, well, you might, but a lot of people wouldn't read it and determine they needed to tender a defense along with a claim. But again, the duty of the insurer is to put the interests of the insured at least equal to their own under Kansas law. So, finally, to save their company and to avoid personal liability for their key officers and directors as individuals, the insured entered into a settlement agreement. Now, I want to make it clear, under Kansas law, you can trigger liability for damages beyond the policy limits by acting negligently or in the absence of good faith. Now, good faith requires a duty to provide coverage, a duty to investigate, a duty to put the interests of the insured ahead of the insurers, a duty to negotiate a settlement, and a duty to communicate. The negligent acts of AIG were then analyzing the wrong policy. That's probably the most negligent thing. They looked at the wrong words. Second, they failed to investigate the claim of each respondent, giving consideration to each of the insured's differing interests. And remember, you had everybody from the CFO to the CEO to a holding company to the officers of the holding company were all defendants or respondents in this arbitration. They didn't take 1 minute to think about their interests when they get sued. And of course, that was the big issue to the insured. They had to hire 12 different lawyers. They had to defend a $26 million claim for individuals. It put the insured in an incredible box by the simple act of saying there's no coverage for this matter. They found there was no coverage. Obviously, that's an act of negligence. Acting on their finding there was no coverage, they could have waited. They could have a court's reserve rights, right? A reservation of rights letter would have come out 95% of the time. They could have said, you know, we don't think there's coverage, but we're going to reserve our rights, your rights, and we're going to just put it on pause and see what happens. Maybe do a little more inquiry. Mr. Usinger didn't even pick up the telephone to call the insurance broker, to call his insured. There was zero investigation besides the eight corners analysis. Fifth.
At what point would that have been appropriate?
Probably when he was
to do the investigation.
Probably when he was analyzing the claim and reaching this determination. The purpose of this letter is to tell you there's no coverage.
Prior to the Prior to
Absolutely.
Prior to the issuance of that letter as opposed to prior to the letter to nowhere.
Right. I mean, clearly they could have picked up the phone later and contacted him and said, we want to look at this again or whatever. But what is the insured?
Or to have differentiated amongst the participants that are insured.
There is a difference in the participants who are insured. For instance, they only treated one company, BSR Financial Services, Inc. That's not the holding company or the control people that were running the business. That was BSR Group, a different entity. And they don't address it to the myriad of other insureds who are the individuals, the officers and directors. They were only looking at one thing. And if you read, have looked at Mr. Usinger's deposition, it is replete with perfunctory, I was doing what I was told, the folks upstairs marked the box that I was supposed to use for the exclusion. I was just, in fact, he said it was a no-brainer. It was the easiest thing he'd ever done was deny this. So that's how much investigation he put into it.
Well, it's simplicity itself. So you're saying at least with one of the paths of negligence was that they failed to compare the coverages to the facts.
Well, the biggest error was they failed to look at the right policy.
Okay.
So they analyzed it with the wrong policy. Who would do that? That seems so axiomatic that you would look at the right policy. But under these facts, he looked at the wrong policy. And that triggered a whole bunch of decisions by him that arguably came from the more narrow language of others for a fee. You know,
I'm looking theoretically in terms of, say, what pigeonhole we're in, and at some point this goes to bad faith.
Correct.
If you're negligent enough and something's brought to your attention, you're going to move into bad faith.
Well, under Kansas law, bad faith, which is a shorthand handle for it, is negligence in how you handle the claim and the absence of good faith as evidenced by your actions. It's a contractual theory, not a tort theory.
And for my information, perhaps other members of the court, if there's a bad faith claim, are attorney's fees covered?
Yes, under Kansas law. And, of course, we're claiming those as well as some other things, including interest for a long period of time now.
Okay.
The other acts of negligence, if I may real quickly, they failed to deliver the mail, so they mishandled the mail that clearly on the face of the envelope they received, Mr. Burton confirmed they received it, and they failed to respond to what we call the pushback letter. The information in the pushback letter, the offer to settle, the case law in the pushback letter, they never even looked at. That's negligence. And of course, finally, failing to respond to the settlement offer. The Kansas courts have found over and over again that not necessarily within limits, but failing to respond at all to a settlement offer is an act of negligence of the insurer.
And was the settlement offer contained in that letter, was that the $3 million settlement offer?
Right. And the letter is addressed to two different insurance companies. One is the errors and omission coverage from AIG and AIG Company. The other addressee on the letter was National Union. Neither one of these companies have any employees. And all of their claims are handled by AIG domestic claims, both are. But, for whatever reason, they have two different claims adjusters handling, or claims analysts, handling the separate claims, the E&O claim and the D&O claim. And so the offer was for both, and there was no response from either, or, you know, either or both of the claims analysts. So it was unresponded to.
Okay, and so the policy limits on the D&O, that was $2 million, correct?
Correct.
And what was the policy limits on the other?
Was $1 million. And what the client didn't know at that moment was that the errors and omission policy had been wasted away to zero by virtue of the law firm that AIG hired to handle some other arbitrations for him under that policy, and they just blew all the money. That's why one of the claims against AIG American Specialty Lines of Pittsburgh, no, American Specialty Lines, which was the other original defendant, was that you blew our policy, you blew our coverage by wasting it on the attorney's fees when he should have been in there trying to settle the case. And whether we could have ever gotten excess judgment or damages, I don't know. But clearly on the handling of this claim, under this policy, AIG was domestic and at least AIG domestic claims was negligent at least seven different ways. And going to your question, Justice Lerman, I don't know whether it's a weighing test on how much negligence is too much, but by the time you look at the wrong policy, By the time you don't respond to correspondence from your insured, by the time, I mean, it's almost fraudulent what they did here. Clearly their actions, of negligent actions, caused this insured to walk away and think, I'm not covered. And then we come to the scramble of what are we going to do about this? And eventually they settled, and they paid $1.5 million in cash, much less than the $3 million. And the only other thing of value that they had was this potential, hard-fought claim against the biggest insurance carrier in the world. And the plaintiffs in the case accepted that and took the assignment. And that's why we're here. So,
does the exclusion language for a fee, that's not the language that they were looking at, right, AIG, when they denied the policy?
The difference is for others.
For others.
So Okay. Arguably a fee is your salary, maybe. But for others means you're getting a fee from somebody else.
And is AIG's policy or National's position, it doesn't matter if we look at that language, the correct language, or the language that we looked at, there's still no coverage for this?
I think that's a fair understanding of it. But my question to the court is, others must mean something. And if it wasn't analyzed before all of this water went over the dam because of this decision, that act of negligence they have to own. And they have to own it, and they owe duties to the insured and their assignees, and they need to take care of it. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely. I'll even offer Jake to help.
Mr. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Scott Paul. I'm representing National Union. At counsel table is my co-counsel, Jay Kane. I'll be doing the arguing today for National Union. Mr. Kane will appear on briefs with me. Before we get into my prepared remarks, I thought I would address a few of the poster boards that have been put up here by the plaintiff's counsel. First of all, let's start with the endorsement. The professional errors and the exclusion, the focus has been on this for others for a fee. Let me tell you what the testimony was with Mr. Usinger, who was the claims representative who handled that. First of all, the district court didn't get a chance, or the district court heard this argument, but did not rule on this argument specifically because it was not preserved as error by the pursuant to the local rule. It was argued in court, but it wasn't preserved in the briefs, which there's a local rule that the court noted. But nevertheless, Mr. Usinger testified that he looked at the entire D&O policy. He testified he assumed all the facts of the Perry claim were true. So the fact that in his letter that he sent out, that he quoted this policy exclusion that Mr. Spray is saying was erroneous, there's no indication, it's just speculation as to whether that's what he relied on, when in the testimony is clearly he looked at the policy. And there's nothing in the record to show that he intentionally looked at a different policy. But even if he looked at the wrong policy, And this language was not there, it doesn't make any difference. The construction of the exclusion is still the same. You still get to the same point on the professional services exclusion. So
my understanding of the argument isn't necessarily that had he looked at the correct policy language, the result would have been different. It's in analyzing whether he acted in good faith or non-negligently by looking at the wrong policy.
A couple things. I think that there is no duty on the part, there has to be a duty to defend, first of all, for some of these arguments to have any application. As far as the policy he looked at, I don't think that there's any law in Kansas that addresses the issue of the obligation of a claims representative to look at the policy and find the right policy. These are matters of contract. And I think whether he looked at the right policy or the wrong policy, he would get to the same conclusion. I don't think there's a material difference in the language as to whether or not the for others for a fee is there, or whether it's for a fee, or how that is stated in his letter that he sent out. At the end of the day, even if he looked at the wrong policy, even if he made a mistake in writing the letter, the evidence is clear from his deposition that's in the record that he looked at the policy that was issued to VSR. Now, let me also address the other poster board. There was much made of the AIG Domestic Claims, Inc. issue, and the letter, the fact that it was addressed to Mr. Caruso. Mr. Caruso was the claims representative for Ace Lake, American Special Lines, the other named defendant in this case, who's settled out. It was just one letter, one envelope, addressed to Caruso and Usinger at this address. The district court said, look, there may be some factual issues here about whether or not this letter was received by National Union, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because there was no offer contained in this pushback letter that was in this envelope, nor in the settlement demand letter that was enclosed with that. There was no offer to settle within the policy limits. National Union had a $2 million policy limit. American International had a $1 million policy limit. There's a global settlement demand presented here for $3 million, and AIG's policy or National Union's policy being only $2 million, they didn't have an opportunity to settle within the policy limits because it was a $3 million demand. So that is the issue that the court resolved this matter so as to not get involved in all these factual disputes about whether the letter was lost, which it wasn't, whether it was ever received, which it clearly was not received by National Union.
So wasn't this directed to both carriers, though?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Wasn't the letter directed to both insurance companies?
No, Your Honor. It was addressed to AIG Domestic Claims. It was addressed to Mr. Caruso and Mr. Usinger. It did reference both policies. It did that, but nowhere in the pushback letter did it make any demand for a specific dollar amount. That was the demand letter that was enclosed with it. It had the $3 million demand. So it was not received by Mr. Usinger because the plaintiffs who hired a coverage attorney in Kansas to write this letter, he ghostwrote the letter, he elected to send it in one envelope and send one letter to National Union and to American International together. Mr. Caruso, the American International claims representative, he did get the letter. He did respond. He said that there's no coverage because coverage had been exhausted. Mr. Usinger never got the opportunity to respond to the letter because it was just one letter and it went to Caruso. He didn't get it. So,
does that matter?
I don't think it matters at all, Your Honor, because the receipt doesn't make any difference if what was to be received was an offer that didn't come within the policy limits. Because it was a $3 million offer, $2 million policy limits for National Union, I don't think it mattered at all. Mr. Justice Pirtle, you had a question earlier about a coverage opinion and whether or not this was a claim. I thought it was you. Clearly, the only thing requested here was a coverage opinion. There was no claim made. There was no tender of the defense made. And I thought I heard Mr. Spray say that because there was no coverage determined by National Union, that's why there was no tender. Well, that doesn't make any difference. Even if there was a determination by National Union that there was no coverage, it doesn't mean that the plaintiffs in this case were not able to go back and tender the defense, which they should have done if they were interested in getting a defense. But the district court was very clear about the fact that National Union never received a tender of the defense from the plaintiffs in the pushback letter. While that could be construed to be a tender of the defense, that occurred in November, and there's a time period on the tender of the defense. There's a 30-day from when you get the claim. If you're going to tender the defense, you have to do it within 30 days. This tender, to the extent it was a tender, occurred several months down the road, and the district court noted that that was untimely.
Wait, which one occurred several months down the road? This demand, the one that contained the settlement letter?
The pushback letter, the settlement letter was enclosed, the settlement demand letter from Mr. Spray was enclosed with the pushback letter. That was sent November 3rd.
But the request for the coverage opinion was sent within the 30-day time period, correct?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
So what's the purpose of a tender of defense and the 30-day requirement?
Well, it gives the opportunity to the insured
If they don't want to incur the defense costs, they can tender the defense to the insurance company, in which case they retain panel counsel. The panel counsel, which was done by ASLIC, by the way, they had Patrick Griffin from Keetac Rock defending the case on the individual E&O carrier claims.
Isn't the 30-day requirement, though, really for the benefit of the insurer, so that claims don't become stale, they have the opportunity to talk to witnesses while things are fresh, all of those types of things?
Well, I think it probably is, but by the same token, the insurer gets the benefit of that as well, because they're getting a defense, because they've tendered the defense, they bargained for that. In this case, there are reasons why that they may not want to have tendered the defense, and reasons why they may have elected to ask for only a coverage opinion. The reason being, sometimes you don't want the limits to be exhausted, because to the extent defense costs are paid by the insurance company in this case, the defense cost, those amounts paid, reduce the amount that's available to pay for indemnity.
Doesn't the policy begin with the premise that there is no defense?
Policy begins with the premise that there is no duty to defend.
Exactly.
Yes. That's in bold letters in several places in the policy.
So the whole idea of tender of defense is for an insured to have the opportunity to request defense.
Yes. And the insured is in control over whether or not they make that request. In this case, but it has to be made timely. In this case, it wasn't made timely. The district court noted that fact, and the district court found there was no tender of the defense. The other thing that...
The 30-day that we're talking about, that was contained within the policy, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there also a time limit on how long the company had to respond to whether they were going to defend or not?
No, I don't believe there was. Let me check my notes to make sure I've covered everything that Mr. Spray raised that I wanted to address. Well, the other thing is that when we're talking about this pushback letter, I mentioned it was written by Mr. Faber, who is a lawyer in Kansas who ghostwrote it for the general counsel of BSR, Mr. Stanfield. Mr. Stanfield said when he signed that letter, he knew that there were two insurance companies involved. He knew that there were two separate policies. He knew that there were two separate policy limits under the two policies. Yet they elected to send one letter to both insurance companies. I think that's an indication that it explains how the message didn't get to National Union, but it also explains how it should have gotten to National Union. There should have been a letter to National Union. There should have been a letter to ASLIC. Instead, they elected to send it in this fashion, and that's where the problem came with National Union not getting a copy of the letter. Now, the other thing I'd like to point out, when we're talking about the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. And so many of the issues that we see arise in these insurance cases arise out of the fact that an insurance company has the duty to defend, but yet they don't honor that duty. And so then the insured is placed in a position where they have to engage in either hiring their own counsel, or maybe they have to go to the extent of what happened here in this case, where they agree to a settlement agreement, they assign their rights, and those rights then are brought by assignees. In this situation, so you can understand why the duty to defend is important, but it was clear in this case that there was no duty to defend. And so Kansas law takes that proposition, and much if not all of the case law cited by the plaintiffs is based on duty to defend cases. That places that, in those cases, place certain burdens on the insurance company, certain duties on the insurance company to deal fairly with their insurers. But without that duty to defend, this is just an indemnity policy. And it's an indemnity policy that has the opportunity to tender if the insured wants to, but if the insured chooses not to for whatever reason, maybe they want to have their own lawyer handle the case, then they are allowed to do that.
Why would a company inquire whether there's coverage if they don't want to take advantage of that coverage?
I think that was a carefully worded letter. And I can't speculate as to why Mr. Stanfield, who wrote the letter, who was a lawyer, requested only a coverage opinion. But he clearly had the opportunity to request to submit it and say, here's a claim. I'm tendering the defense. There may or may not be indemnity there under the terms of the policy, but at least he could have tendered the defense. I think it was a carefully worded letter, but to answer your question, I don't know why he selected those terms or that language about a coverage opinion in particular.
What did you think was the breadth of the of the request in the letter?
The request was, I think, to innate, well, first of all, we have to remember the context in, what this, in which the letter was sent. VSR Financial had been defending 11 to 13 different arbitrations in where ASLIC had provided the defense, and there was, because it was an errors and omissions policy, the professional services exclusion wasn't in that policy, so they were defending those cases. Then at the end, plaintiffs are doing what plaintiffs' lawyers will always do. They're looking for more coverage, and they found this D&O policy. So they made a claim in the Perry claim against the DNOs, the directors and officers of VSR, with the intent, with the hope of finding more coverage. And so I think that was what was the context in which this all arose, was they were searching for more coverage, and the hope was that the DNO policy would provide that coverage, which by the terms, we don't think it did. I'm sorry, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I understand your answer is they're sniffing around for more coverage.
Right.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
The other thing I think I would point out to the court is Mr. Stanfield, who is general counsel of VSR, testified that when he sent the pushback letter, he knew that ASLIC and National Union were different companies. He knew they had separate policy limits. He didn't even expect to receive a response to the settlement letter. Their lawyer, Mr. Faber, who is their coverage counsel, told them, don't even expect a response. And maybe that explains why only one letter was sent. And maybe that explains why Mr. Usinger's name was second on the letter. There's also indications in the record that the letter was sent by email, but it was sent to the wrong email address. It's just odd to think that in this type of correspondence that the plaintiffs would elect to send one letter to two different companies, put Mr. Usinger's name second on the letter, and perhaps in the hope that he doesn't get it, and then they try to send it to him at what is the erroneous email address.
This is speculation.
Well, it's accurate that
the facts email may be accurate, but the motivation is,
yes, Your Honor,
speculation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is
yes,
that right?
They're
making facts.
That's my argument based on those facts.
They're making record facts during the to-ing and fro-ing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And finally, Mr. Stanfield said it didn't matter to him what the response was going to be. The response, whether it was they were going to take action with, National Union was going to take action with respect to the pushback letter or not, it didn't matter. They were going to settle the claim either way. They were intending to settle the claim either way, regardless. And so that's just another indication that this was an afterthought, that trying to get coverage from the D&O carrier was just an afterthought on the part of the plaintiffs because they didn't want to leave any stone unturned. So what does this all mean? It means there's no duty to defend. It's clearly stated in the policy. There was no tender within 30 days of the claim. That's clear and from the facts of the case. Even if it was timely, even if the pushback letter was received by Mr. Usinger on behalf of National Union, it's clear that there was no demand within the policy limits. And the reason why that's a big deal, demand within the policy limits, and insurance companies can help responsible for that, because if they've got the control over the defense, then they've got the obligation to protect the insured if they have that control over the defense. And if they can get the insured out of the case for less than the policy limits so the insured has no excess exposure, the insurance companies have a duty to try to do that. And so that's a situation where when we have this policy limits defense requirement here, it's for the benefit of the insured. But if you don't make a demand, if you're the plaintiffs and you're not making a demand within the policy limits, that issue never comes into play. And I think I may have mentioned this, but just in the off chance that I didn't, the fact that there was no coverage here does not mean that there could not have been a tender of the defense by the plaintiffs had they elected to do so. Doesn't mean that National Union had a duty to defend, but without that duty, without that tender, the National Union had to understand or had to assume that the VSR and the directors and officers were going to handle this case on their own. It didn't stop them from coming back and presenting a claim for indemnity at some later point, but they certainly had, they could have challenged the coverage opinion. Mr. Usinger said, look, if there's anything else you want me to consider, let me know. I'm happy to consider anything else. Interestingly, Mr. Caruso did send a letter back to them and saying there's no coverage anymore because you've exhausted the limits under the ASLIC policy. What Mr. Usinger did was he closed his file because he didn't receive any further communication. If he would have received this communication, if he would have received the letter, he certainly would have responded. But he didn't, and so he closed the file. Mr. Spray said the letter was lost. It wasn't lost. It was delivered. The one letter was delivered exactly to the person who it was addressed to on the top line, Mr. Caruso. So, Your Honors, what I would like to do is I'd like to restate my prayer here in terms of what the relief we're requesting from this court. We're requesting that the court affirm the judgment of the lower court, the district court, Judge Merritt. There were two summary judgment orders. There was an interim order that addressed some of the mechanics of the case. But ultimately, this case is before the court because judgment was entered on the first and third claims of the plaintiffs against National Union. And we would request the court affirm the judgment of the district court on those claims and dismiss the appeal.
Mr. Paul, before you step away, yes. Is it your position that VSR is in the business of rendering professional services to others for a fee?
Yes.
And if the exclusion applies to anything related to that, is the DNL policy illusory?
Can I have that again?
Sure. If VSR is in the business of providing professional services to others for a fee.
Right.
And the exclusion doesn't provide coverage for any acts related to that.
Right.
Then is the coverage under the DNO policy illusory for VSR?
Well, I would say no for a number of reasons. One of which we would have to speculate as to what other types of claims might be covered that aren't before the court. Certainly in this case, the district court found that there was coverage on one of the four suggested areas that were at issue here. We don't necessarily agree with that, but I don't think that the coverage is illusory because certainly the district court found coverage on the one issue about the files with FINRA and keeping the files accurate with FINRA so that they're available for the public to understand what's going on. But I think it would be speculation to say it's illusory because we don't know what other facts may be out there, what other scenarios that where a director or an officer may want coverage under this policy and it may be afforded.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 4 minutes and 8 seconds.
4 minutes and 8 seconds, Mr. Spray.
And may it please the Court, Your Honor. Justice Ryan, with regard to your last question, you're right. The logical conclusion of their argument is that the exception swallows the policy. And I would go one step further than illusory. I would say it's fraudulent to sell a policy that can never be invoked. That's insane, and that's fraud. And if they defrauded their insurer, that's another act of bad faith. Now, with regard to this board, which, Mr. Paul, I don't know if you want to look at it, but it's your supplemental answer to a request for admission. Right here again, and these are all carefully worded, not just counsel for the insurance carrier, but counsel outside. What they say is the person who is you're responding to, who did all this, is AIG Domestic Claims. That was the authorized representative. So going back to the letter, above all else, it went to AIG Domestic Claims. So when he says that Usinger didn't receive it, it's just not true. Caruso and Usinger work on the same floor of this building. They know each other. They're right down the hall. So it's absurd to think that Rory Burton, who runs the mailroom, gave it to one person, didn't point out who it should go to, the other person, and it ended up being lost to Mr. Usinger. That's the point. If you look at the insuring language, and I'm talking about the first page of the policy, it says the insurer does not assume any duty to defend, Justice Castle, your point. However, the named entity may, at its sole option, tender to the insurer the defense of a claim for which coverage is provided by his policy. End of story. No further inquiry. There is no coverage. So what's the point? Once they determine there's no coverage, however you want to characterize the claim, because they did also send the lawsuit with the claim, with the coverage request, no matter how you look at that, AIG didn't have coverage for something that should have been covered, and once they don't have coverage, all the nonsense about Endorsement 8 and tendering, and if you read Endorsement 8, which is a page and a half, single-spaced, that you get to a point where they say, but we'll reimburse you for your defense costs at the end of the day, it's all pointless. And the bottom line is that under Kansas law, there's lots of ways that you can negligently handle a claim in the absence of good faith. And every contract in Kansas carries with it a duty of good faith. The Kansas courts have adopted that with regard to insurance contracts. You can say all this business about defense and offers inside policy limits, etc., but that's not the only way you can engage in bad faith under an insurance contract in Kansas. There are lots of other ways, and there are lots of general rules about this. Negligence and the absence of good faith. That's a contractual duty, the duty under the contract that AIG owned these insurance. The duty to negotiate, what about that? If they got an offer and they don't respond to it at all, the answer was because you're outside of the policy limits of this one policy. They don't respond to it. Domestic claims doesn't respond to it at all. And again, National Union and Aslake, the other insurance carrier, the E&O carrier, don't have any employees. Nobody works for them. It's a fiction. The only person or entity that has employees is domestic claims. And again, here, over and over they tell us that domestic claims is who handled this claim. Not Mr. Usinger, not Mr. Caruso, but domestic claims. This one big claims company that initially we sued and district court chose to dismiss. I want to close by just, and this is a little risky on my part, but I think the court doesn't even have to address these issues of defense and settlement with inside limits if you reverse on errors 5, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 14. They don't go to that issue, and we'll be back where we want to be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.
Thank you.
Thank you.